Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
You know, it was like going to Fenway Park for the first time, or the Sistine Chapel. I mean, it was, you know, he cut me a few pieces of Gruyere, which I treasured down the road. The funny thing was, there were a couple guys in suits, not behind the counter, but they saw me with my guitar, and they sensed that something odd was afoot.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, are you one of those Kornheiser guys?
No!
This is General George Washington, and you're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This, of course, was Dan Byrne. And Dan Byrne describing his performance at Calvert Woodley the other day on this show, talking about going to La Cheeserie, which, as I've maintained for 12 years on this show, is simply a cheese counter.
Yes.
Don't get carried away. For him to call it the Sistine Chapel is very lovely. This comes from John Brandt. I'm the beer buyer at Calvert Woodley and have been for nearly 3 years. I got my job in part due, or more likely in spite of the fact that I was effusive in my interview with Michael Sands about you and the show podcast. I think Michael's comment was something along the lines of, oh, you're one of those people. Anyway, I was greatly distressed to hear that I missed out on meeting Dan Byrne at the store last Saturday. I must have been on a lunch break or something. Had I been available, I would have offered Dan a bottle of La Cheeserie beer, which is a caramel macchiato, I hope I pronounced that correctly, or macchiato, imperial stout, ask Michael, brewed in honor of your love for coffee ice cream by Shy Bear Brewery in Lewiston, Pennsylvania. Funny story about the beer. The brewery's owner, Jason Eufema, or Eufema, conceived, brewed, and was ready to bottle the beer before he ever contacted us at Calvert Woodley to gauge our interest, support, and or horror in a beer named after our famed cheese counter. We've already had one large order for the beer from a group of loyal littles, and we are hoping to spread the love with a special offer for listeners of the pod. I've attached a picture of the beer bottle for News Channel 8, and this is really lovely. If you go to our website, www.calvertwoodley.com, order the Shy Bear La Cheeserie Caramel Macchiato Stout and use the code TONYBEER10 for a 10% discount on all La Cheeserie bottles purchased. We're able to ship to 13 states, probably the original colonies, I would say, and deliver in the District of Columbia for a small fee, or drop by the store for the full La Cheeserie experience. Come on, people, use the code from John Brandt, which I liked, and also from Thomas Bramble. Thank you for the additional mentions of TB Sellers, and it's C-E-L-L-A-R-S, like your seller, on the show. Naturally, I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts about the wine. Michael, we have not opened that wine.
You have not offered me my bottle. Once you found out how good it was, you decided to keep said bottle.
I didn't open... I have two
bottles. I know you have not opened it.
Was one supposed to be for you?
One was
for
me,
and
you...
Did I miss that memo?
Yes.
Okay. I'll give it to you. The
TB Sellers... You're aging it in your second wine cooler.
The TB Sellers 2019 Cabernet Sauvignon won the double gold at the 2023 San Francisco Chronicle Wine Competition. More than 1,000 wineries and 5,500 bottles competed. This is the first time I've ever entered a wine in competition, so of course I'm stoked. That being said, I do recommend pairing it with something other than chicken nuggets, expired ice cream, or harvested deer carcass. If you're not pulling a prime filet mignon or ribeye out of the Yeti cooler, a cheese plate and or a simple charcuterie, is that how that's pronounced? Charcuterie platter will do. I guarantee my wine will never get you laughed off of a 70-acre private school campus, Yeti cooler or not. That's a wonderful thing. And that's from Tom Brown.
You stumble over charcuterie, but you're okay with macchiato.
Is it macchiato? Well, it's because wasn't there an actor?
Yes, pronounced macchiato.
Yeah, Ralph Macchio.
No, it's a hard K.
Okay.
It's a macchiato.
Good. So Liz and Jeannie are here today, and we have lots to talk about. The Academy Award nominations dropped last night, or dropped yesterday, and Anne will be on later.
Yes.
But I want to give Jean a chance, your sort of overall... I don't know any of these movies. I don't know any of them. Your thoughts are
I know quite a bit.
Yeah.
I don't know as much as Anne,
You watched... You've streamed a lot of these movies?
I've been to movie theaters, actually.
You have?
Yes. Well, when you go
You're
at
so
the time
brave.
That I go, there's okay. three people.
Okay.
Okay, so it's generally safe.
So let's talk
so
about the
I
movies.
I think at the top of my list, and you know, I can be critical. The top of my list is Everything Everywhere All at
that
Once.
That got the most nominations. What is that?
It's unwatchable.
Oh, okay.
And I would say if it had been released 50 years ago, 50% of the audience would have been on acid.
Right.
The other 25 would have been stoned, and I don't know about the last 25%. It is.
Unwatchable. Gene McManus.
I concur. I tried to watch it and I was like, what is this?
I kept hanging in there thinking, okay, there will be some sort of denouement. There will be some way to justify.
Jesse didn't like it either.
To justify the chaos that I have just experienced. And it just boggles my mind that it got all of these nominations.
13 nominations.
Now, the actress is beautiful. She's fabulous. I have loved her in everything I've seen. But I do not. And you know, there's people listening now who are going to say, you old bag, you don't understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. This is like the way we do movies now. And maybe that's true. I am an old bag. But I do. I don't expect a linear structure, but I expect some understanding of what's going on in front of me.
Did it look like, hey kids, let's go to the barn and put on a show? Like it was just so random?
No, it was just chaos.
Chaos.
Okay.
Metaverse. You know about the metaverse, don't you?
No, I don't know.
Okay, so neither did I. And the other thing that bothered me was that the movie Nope was completely overlooked. Nope.
N-O-P-E, Nope?
Yeah, it's a Jordan Peele movie. It came out this summer.
Oh, he's...
Oh, the horror... Okay. Yeah, the alien thing,
I mean, it was really good. I mean, it was very original. He's very original. I thought he might get a nod or two. Kiki Palmer was in it. She was fantastic. I thought she might get Best Supporting Actress. And then my final gripe is that Sarah Polley did not get a nomination for Best Director. Okay, she's a woman. But she directed Women Talking, which is a it's not an easy movie. It's a very bleak, complicated, grim movie. But it takes place in the loft of a barn. And yet it's gripping, it's suspenseful. Mm-hmm. And she did a fabulous job adapting the screenplay. But I don't understand why she did not get a directing nod.
Other than Everything Everywhere All at Once, a lot of, you know, because they've expanded from 5 movies to as many as 10. All Quiet on the Western Front, Avatar, which I wouldn't see if you paid me. The Banshees, Inisherin.
Loved it.
Elvis, did you like Elvis?
Loved it.
The Fabelmans, which is the Spielberg
movie. It's sweet.
Movie. Tar.
It's, you know.
Tar is Cate Blanchett.
She's fabulous, but it's overblown. It is very obscure. It takes so long to get to the point. It's not my favorite.
Women Talking, which you liked.
I really liked.
Triangle of Sadness. That's something I don't think if I'm lining up and it's a 5-plex, I don't think I'm going into Triangle of Sadness.
I haven't
seen
that. The actress in it is supposed to be great.
And Top Gun Maverick, which everybody loved.
I liked.
And
which made money.
She goes insane talking about it.
I liked.
It's not the kind of movie that normally gets nominated.
Right.
Because it's not pretentious. And it's not the product of 61 years of living in a bathtub. And, you know, like most of the movies are, right?
Anyway. No. I also watched All Quiet on the Western Front. I don't know if you're...
I'm watching that tonight. It's streaming.
Fantastic.
I'll bet it's great because 1918 was great.
Yes.
I bet it's great.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, 1918 was great.
It was great.
Was it 1917?
Whatever it was.
1914. Whatever.
Whatever it was.
Yeah,
in 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down to mighty Mississippi.
We took a little bacon and we took a little beans.
We caught the bloody British
town of New Orleans.
We fired our guns and the British kept... All right, so let me get off this and get to the Australian Open.
Yes, there's a transition.
Have you been to all of them other than that?
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
You never got to go
it's
to that.
It's a great regret.
Do you feel you missed something?
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah, I mean, I would like to experience probably every great sporting event, every great venue, iconic, you know, once in my lifetime. So that's a miss. I mean, I was in Australia for a month for the 2000 Olympics.
Okay.
And I actually had it was mainly in Sydney, but I did.
Did you go to Melbourne on a side trip?
No, there was a soccer match.
Okay.
You know, they have to spread soccer around whatever the country is. So I was completely charmed by Melbourne and, you know, really. It's
did
so
you go
fervent.
Over to the tennis? Did you
no.
see?
Okay. No. I did. Yes.
Did you see the Rod Laver court?
No, I just saw like a statue outside.
Okay.
But no, I was enchanted. But that was, oh my God, that was 22 years ago. So no, I've never been to the Australian Open.
I've always thought it was the least of the four, but maybe it isn't. Maybe the French is the least of four. Because Wimbledon and the U.S. Open, they're the most important. Is this the least of the four in your mind, the Australian?
I think so. I mean, no diss, but I'm not even sure it was recognized as a Grand Slam early on. Or I could, well, let's scratch that I said that. I'm not saying literally scratch it, but right. I'm not. But I do know that in the 70s.
For us to scratch it, you have to curse like Carville.
Okay. Well, I'm capable of that. You know. But no, I guess the lumbering point is for many, many years, not all the top players went because it
That's
was
right.
just such a drama
That's
to go.
Right.
And for a long time, it conflicted with World Team Tennis. So right when that was launched and a lot of players like Chris Evert or, you know, others were trying to help that launch, they just didn't go to the Australian Open. So the records, if you go back to who's won the most, it's not necessarily on a par.
I was curious about something. Yeah. You wrote a story last week in anticipation of it that Djokovic, who had been deported, literally
yes.
deported yep. last year for lying on his visa application, lying like a dog, and they threw him out of the country. You wrote a story about he was welcomed back. And can you explain that? And can you explain why yeah. that happened?
Yeah. You know, I wish I could. I'm sure there are many, many layers. I mean, first of all, he's capable of incredible charm and humor. And he's very good with crowds. He can win them over very quickly. You know, this Australian Open, well, tennis in general, and it's hard to talk about this Australian Open without the macro pivot that the sport is being forced to make with the retirement of Serena, the retirement of Federer, you know, and the aging out of
Nadal,
of the older stars. And, you know, I think people see Nadal's end is quite close at hand. And Novak is, you know, kind of the last guy standing, although Andy Murray certainly was heroic.
Well, he's
for
standing
his
on titanium hips.
Yeah. But, you know, so I don't know enough about the Australian ethos to say it's just a very forgiving place or like live in the moment and last year's last year, or, you know, this sense that, boy, we really overreacted to the pandemic a year ago. Now we have our head on straight. Let's just, you know,
okay.
That was too harsh. I don't know what it was, but he is a magnetic athlete and a super charming guy, you know, when he wants to be.
And he should win. He is by far.
It is so brutal. I mean, he has just like a buzzsaw through, you know, this morning at 3:30 a.m., his quarterfinal didn't even last 2.5 hours, I don't think. It was another straight sets against the world's number 4 or 5 player.
And he's won this thing more than anybody has
Correct.
Won this thing.
9 times. So yeah. He's going for 10, and more
and then
importantly,
we'll tie.
Would tie. The 22.
And he will break that. He will surpass Nadal.
I can't fathom that he won't.
Because he's still a great player.
And he takes such care of his body and for the long haul. I mean, he had a little hamstring issue. He had a hamstring issue, but there's no sense that his body is betraying him at 35.
We, meaning the American men, we did pretty well.
Yes, but in a really odd,
but
unexpected
our
way.
Our best ones lost pretty early.
Yes.
Fritz lost early and Tiafoe lost early.
Yes, exactly.
But we appear to be sort of the middle class of tennis at this point. We got a lot of people from 20 to 60. We don't have a lot of people in the top 20 or the top 10. We got one guy and he's never won anything, Taylor Fritz. Are we making a comeback? Are we making a comeback, or should we not pay too much attention to this because we're really not threats to win anything?
Definitely a comeback, just because the low point was so very, very low, you know, in the wilderness since Andy Roddick 20 years ago won, you know, the last American man to win a slam, you know, and with Serena retiring, Venus rarely advancing past the first round of a tournament, but in such a interesting way keeps competing. You know, the landscape of American men's tennis was just it wasn't even, you couldn't even comment on it. There was nothing there.
Right.
So it is a comeback. I think what needs to be, what's yet to be proven by this cohort of 20-somethings is the mental fortitude that you often see in other countries. There just seems to be a blitheness in about a lot of American, you know, someone jump in if I'm like,
well, I
being
mean,
unfair, but
no.
I mean, it's kind of attractive and entertaining, but I just have not known them to open a vein to win or, you know, and I'd love to see that.
So I used to cover tennis a long, long time ago.
Speak.
And I will say this, that Jimmy Connors was the toughest guy out there.
Yes.
Jimmy Connors would go to the net and hit you in the face with his racket. No, I'm not saying he's a good person.
No, in a gritty background.
Yes.
But Jimmy Connors was exactly what you're talking about. And in those days, European players, Connors would say, none of them are worth anything. They have no guts. They won't stay in there.
Yes.
And he said that about all European players, even ones that beat him. He would try to beat them the next time. McEnroe wasn't like that. McEnroe was tough in a very sarcastic, intellectual way, but he wasn't tough like Connors. Connors would die out there.
Yeah, the street fighter guy.
Connors would happily die out there.
Yes.
And we don't, and it doesn't seem to me.
I'm not seeing that.
That Connors had what I would call a football mentality. And I don't see that in any of these players, do you?
No.
No.
I mean, that's sort of what you think of Nadal as a guy that's just out there giving everything, refusing to give anything.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you look at that and say.
But, and you know, a lot on the women's side in particular, a lot of the Eastern Europeans, you know, who really, that is the one powerful ticket, you know, to take care of their families, to have a great life. You know, it's not like in the U.S. where as a young child, you might have 8 sports to choose from. And gee, today I like soccer. Today I want to try field hockey. And, you know, in our land of plenty, I'm not dissing that we have a lot of options, you know, especially kids who grow up middle class or, you know, it's just a land of plenty. And it's hard. It's the rare person that, with those opportunities, brings that killer, I'm going to die for this because this is all that matters.
Well, Serena Williams did that.
Yes.
Is she done?
Oh, no one in their right mind would speak for Serena or count her out in any way. I would think she's done.
Right.
You know, in terms of being on the tour. And I know she kind of alluded to wanting to have a second child. So I have not heard anything in the way that Naomi Osaka recently said, I'm going to have a baby. It's like, wow, okay, I see why you're not playing this year. So I don't know where Serena stands on that. I think if she does get pregnant and, you know, that would kind of tell you she probably is done because that would push back.
Takes her out a couple of years.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We'll take a break. Richie, when we return, Richard Justice.
Oh,
that's right.
Wow.
We did that as a surprise for you. Richard Justice will talk about the Hall of Fame and about the non-sale, apparently, of the Los Angeles Angels. What are they called these years? The Anaheim Angels in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I think that's it.
The California Angels in Los Angeles. You're not in Los Angeles. Okay, you're not. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua, and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter, and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film, and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
These songs are sent to us by Sean Tweedley, who's in a band called Mind Rip, M-I-N-D-R-I-P-P. It's the second time writing to send music. We played 2 of his songs in November, and there's a whole bunch of new songs. Although he says it's tough to top Gary and the Marching Band and the Haunting Sounds of the Deep Sea, but I'm trying. This is called Color Me So Bright, and it plays in Richard Justice. You can listen to these songs at the end of everything. Plays in Richard. Richard! We got to start with the fact that to my surprise, and I will say to my surprise, there was somebody elected to the Hall of Fame yesterday, and it is Scott Rolen. What are your thoughts about that?
I think I'm surprised also. It seemed like we were trending toward having no one.
Yeah.
Last year, one guy, David Ortiz, the year before that, none. And that followed a trend in the 6 years prior, in the six elections between 2014 and 2019, we elected 20 players. I say we, I don't vote anymore.
Right.
We elected 20 players, then two the following year, Ortiz and Roland in the 3 years since. So I think it was sort of cleaning out the ballot. But, he's a prototype third baseman. He was a prototype, in my mind, a prototype Hall of Famer. One time, the highest compliment I heard about him, he was a seven-time All-Star, played 17 years, eight gold gloves, is that when he was injured 1 year, the general manager of the Reds, Walt Jocketty, asked him to travel with the team. They thought his presence was enough, they needed his presence in the clubhouse. Interestingly, there have only been two third basemen debut in the last 40 years that have made the Hall of Fame, Chipper Jones and now Scott Rolen. He's just the 18th third baseman in the Hall. That's the position with the lowest representation. It's interesting. I think he belongs there. Todd Helton missed by 11 votes. I think he'll get in. Billy Wagner missed by, I think, 25 votes. He'll get in. And then next year, Adrian Beltre and Chase Utley are our first-timers. I would think they will both get in. So it comes and goes.
So I'm going to just bang my head against the wall now on Scott Rolen. I mean, I think Scott Rolen belongs in the Hall of the Very Good. I think he's a very good player. I don't think he's a Hall of Fame player. I don't think he's a great player. I think that the Hall of Fame has been undercut a little bit lately with the Old Timers Committee or whatever they call it these days, putting in people that, again, I think are very good but not great. And what I would say, and I'll ask this, pose this in the form of a question, is he better than Don Mattingly? Don Mattingly's not in. Don Mattingly had five years. Almost incomparable. I know you can make the argument against Don Mattingly, but is Scott Rolen better than Don Mattingly?
Well, he had a longer career, but I think what you're saying is, do you believe in a big hall or a small hall? And the small hall is Frank Robinson and Hank Aaron and Sandy Koufax. That's a small hall. No, I mean, guys, you don't have to look at Willie Mays's statistics to say Willie Mays is in the Hall of Fame. You know, he walks it, he talks it, he's a Hall of Famer.
Right.
But the big hall theory is the best players of the generation belong in. Does Scott Rolen deserve to stand alongside Pi Trainer, Brooks Robinson, the people like that? And that's a conversation that seems to have evolved. In the years 25 years ago and prior to that, I think guys believed in a small hall. You know, there were no unanimous. Hank Aaron was not unanimous.
Right.
Koufax wasn't unanimous. I know a guy that didn't vote for Seaver, and I told him, I said, I don't know where you're setting your bar, but it might be a little high.
If
Tom Seaver does not get your vote, you might want to rethink it. And I had a friend, in fact, that didn't vote for Mickey Mantle, and Dick Young, the irascible columnist in New York for years and years, called him up and said, and was going to eviscerate him. Now, the reason the guy didn't vote for Mickey Mantle, he thought Mickey Mantle treated him like a jerk. But what he told Dick Young, and he had to come up with an answer quickly because he was going to get taken apart in the pages of the New York Daily News, was, well, I just don't believe that anybody should get in on the first ballot. And Dick Young bought it. He believed it. He was from that generation of writers that, hey, maybe we'll put Babe Ruth in on the first ballot, but I'm not sure about anybody else.
Well, I'll go through the comparison. I was walking a dog this morning, and I was thinking about this. Is Scott Rolen, is he better than Nolan Arenado? Nolan Arenado is going to get 12 gold gloves when he's done, and I think his batting number is going to be higher. Is he better than Alex Bregman? These are contemporary third basemen, right? And I'm not knocking Scott Rolen. I'm just, and then ultimately what I got to is Ryan Zimmerman going to make the Hall of Fame?
In the case of Ryan Zimmerman, I think he is in the Hall of Very Good, and he's probably not going to make it.
Right.
As someone that in the length of Scott Rolen's career.
That's a long
time. He's awfully good.
Yes.
And,
yes.
But what you're saying is, he elite? Like, Brooksy Robinson will be talked about till the end of time. I mean, the videos of him in the 70 World Series will be looked at forever.
Yes.
Will Scott Rolen be like that? I can't say that. I can't say that he deserved a seat alongside Tom Seaver in the hearts and minds of baseball fans. He's at a different level. Now, does that mean he belongs in the Hall of Fame? That's a discussion that has evolved quite a bit in the writers' voting.
Yeah, I mean, Hall of Fames are tough for me.
Right.
There is no way that Tracy McGrady should be in the Basketball Hall of Fame. This is no way. He never got to the second round of the playoffs. You know, in a sport where one guy is differential. You know, he never did it. It's much tougher in baseball because you just can't take your team to the World Series. It doesn't work that way. It's much harder. And again, I'm not knocking Scott Rolen.
Right.
Did he win any World Series? I mean, did he win an MVP? Was he even an MVP? Did he win something? And so it's hard.
He was Rookie of the Year. He won 8 Gold Gloves.
Yeah,
you're right. He's in the. It's a very difficult conversation. And what has tainted the conversation is that one of these second chance committees put Harold Baines in. I love Harold Baines.
He's not
from Eastern Shore, Maryland. He doesn't belong in the Hall of Fame.
No.
I'm not sure Bill Mazeroski belongs in the Hall of Fame, although his calling card was, I might be the greatest third defensive second baseman of all time.
Right.
But that has changed the dynamics of what the Hall of Fame should look like.
Well, the other enormous change is these steroid guys.
Mm. Right.
That's
because if these steroid guys were in, we wouldn't be talking about Scott Rolen.
Are they adjusting their thinking because they've ruled out the steroid guys?
Well, now wait a minute. You're right. This is Jeannie. This is why I stopped voting. I'm so ticked off about how we handle the steroid guys. You have people that are awarded the high. We have voted steroid users into the Hall of Fame the last 10 years. There is no question about it. But so we award guys that got away with it, we give them the highest honor in the game.
Yeah.
The guys that got caught got punished. And so what do you do? When you can't look at a ballot now and say, I know this guy did and I know this guy did, you can't do that. So what do? You guess. And it infuriates me that if you put Bonds and Clemens on the ballot, vote for what he did on the field. Now you're going to say, if you just look at Rogers' stats from Boston, he's arguably a Hall of Famer. Before Bonds added all that slabs of muscle, 494 career home runs.
Yes.
Back when 494 career home runs got you in the Hall of Fame. And you're going to say, well, what about the ethics of it? The ethics of it is the game looked the other way. We put the commissioner that oversaw the steroid era, and he's a friend of mine, Bud Selig. We put him in the Hall of Fame. And Hall of Famers, the older guys, a lot of them are upset about it and down the line. But to me, it's not a Hall of Fame if you don't have the best right-handed pitcher of all time and the best left-handed hitter of all time.
I don't think there's any question about that. If Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds aren't in the Hall of Fame, and again, I'm going to use Scott Rolen here, and it's wrong of me to do. But if he's in and they're not, I mean, really, what are we talking about here? It's Sammy Sosa. He went over 60 three times. Nobody's ever done this.
Well, see, you know, you and I grew up in an era when 60 was a sacred number for baseball fans. 61 was a sacred number.
Sure.
All those numbers don't mean anything now because of the steroid era. It's hard to differentiate. Does Mark McGwire belong in the Hall of Fame? Does Sosa belong in the Hall of Fame? And it just got too complicated.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is good on that. I need to ask you, Artie Moreno not selling. if you're Shohei Ohtani, is that good news or bad news?
I think if you're an Angels fan, it's bad news. He bought the team in 2003. He bought a team that was the defending World Series champions. They made the playoffs 5 times in 7 years. In 13 years since, 0 playoff wins. Now,
one time in.
And does he look at, and you have the best player in baseball, Mike Trout.
Yeah.
You gave him the most money. You gave Ohtani now for 5 years, no playoffs. You draw 3 million fans every year. You spend money. Anthony Rendon got a lot of money. But you haven't done it right. And you would think a guy that failed year after year after year would look at himself and say, maybe we're running this thing wrong. You know, I see the Dodgers doing things a certain way, the Padres doing certain things a certain way, going to the playoffs, igniting the fans around here, and we're not doing anything. But he's not going to change, and I doubt the Angels are going to be a factor in the American League West going forward.
I agree with that. I mean, I think that's a guy. You've got the best player in baseball.
Right.
In Trout. You have maybe the best baseball asset in the history of the game in Ohtani.
I've
never seen anything like him. You had a pitching staff last year that finished ninth in the entire league. That means 21 teams had a worse ERA than the Angels, and we didn't get a sniff of the playoffs. If you're the owner, you have to go to somebody, honestly, like Theo Epstein. And you have to say, if you don't want to run it, tell me who should run it, and here's an open checkbook. Right?
Exactly. And regarding Ohtani, you know, the Dodgers sort of took the offseason off in terms of spending. And I think game thinks they're preparing a contract for Ohtani that probably will start with a five that will be bigger than any contract ever.
Well, he's always on the field. All right? He never misses a game one way or another.
And he wants to win.
Yeah, it's up. All right. Richie, thank you so much.
Bye, Richie.
Bye.
Bye.
Richard Justice, boys and girls. We will take a break. And then Ann Hornaday will come and incur the wrath of Jean McManus.
No, she won't. No. Everyone's entitled to their opinion.
Not if it's
hers is much more informed than mine, I assure you.
But yours is better. Come on.
I don't know about that.
Let's get out of here. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss, 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Tony Kornheiser Show.
Once again, this is Mind Rip, MindRipp. You can find them on Spotify. Or him. Sean Tweedley is the person who does this. This is a song called Edith Keeler. Not Edith Saliza, but
Edith Keeler. A distant relative.
And not Ruby Keeler. Remember Ruby Keeler, the actress Ruby Keeler?
I remember.
You only have to be 80 to remember.
Yeah, she was even before our time.
Wasn't Wee Willie Keeler?
Wee Willie Keeler was a good leadoff hitter.
Yeah.
Michael, if people like Sean Tweedley want to send in their original music, how do they do it?
Please send us your music by emailing it to jingles@tonykornheiser.com.
I have to tell people that Michael's been so brave today. Michael has taken the dog out
of
here.
And I'll see you later.
Yeah. And has sacrificed himself for the greater good of the show by taking the dog out of here. Ann Hornaday joins us now. And Gene and Liz are here. And Gene has already started in on Everything Everywhere All at Once. Let's start with the movies before we get to the individual performances. Just your thoughts on anything that should have been nominated that isn't nominated, and of course, on your position on Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Well, you know, I will preface this by saying I didn't think last year was a particularly strong year. You know, just between us chickens, there was not anything that I was jumping up and down about. You know, I mean, I think we've already talked. I did choose Top Gun as my favorite because it was the most fun I had. You know, frankly, I was just looking for the thing that made me feel good and sort of gave me a great time at the movies, and that was the movie that did. But it's not that I think it is the greatest work of cinematic art ever, you know, ever made or anything like that. And so I would have liked to have seen a little bit more love for She Said. You know,
yeah.
I think She Said is sort of a return to that classical form of filmmaking that we all probably grew up thinking that's what a movie is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't, I just think there's this new, you know, and we'll talk about it with Everything Everywhere, right? It's like, I think we're in a generational shift where we're now seeing work by people for whom a movie isn't All the President's Men anymore, you know, or 3 Days of the Condor, or even Tootsie, you know? So that's kind of my conflict in terms of just sort of knowing how to evaluate things and being fair to movies. But yeah, I would have liked to have seen more love for She Said. And Everywhere, Everything Everywhere, I just thought it was a mess.
Thank you.
It was hard to watch, and it was repetitive, and I'm not that much of an aficionado of the martial arts stuff. And then the mother-daughter story, when it kicks in, because that's what it turns out being all about, it just flattened me. I was very affected by that, you know? I was very affected by the emotional meaning of the movie, but I thought the filmmaking itself was chaotic and, you know, indulgent and just too... But it's a phenomenon. I mean, like, I saw it late in the summer because I missed it the first time. I think I was probably out of town when it screened, by which time it had become a cult phenomenon. You know, I mean, the auditorium I saw it in was packed with repeat viewers. So it is definitely resonating with people. And, you know, it's like, again, that could probably be more of a generational thing than anything else.
Can I ask this question? It takes about a year to make a movie. So all of these movies were made during the height of the pandemic.
Yeah.
When nobody was going to theaters and the availability to watch a movie was somehow in your home in one form or another. Do you think in any way that has led to sort of a more inner looking kind of movie? Because you're not going
definitely.
To the... You know what I'm saying?
Definitely, Tony. Yeah. And I was actually just talking about this when I was in L.A. a couple of weeks ago. And bumped into somebody on the, you know, like you bump into people on the street who are in the business all the time.
Right.
And we absolutely did talk about that. And I think, you know, I first saw it with Belfast, with the Kenneth Branagh movie, because he's like, you know, I didn't have anything to do. So I thought I let my memories come. And I kind of was, people were able to be still and just sort of ruminate and think back. And then we see it with Fablemans, you know. We see it with Armageddon Time. Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And I do think there's something, and I'm actually, you're going to help me work this out, and because I do want to write about it. But there's some kind of connection between that impulse, and then this kind of the controls are off, you know, like
yeah.
Like there aren't the structural guardrails anymore to say you've got to turn it in at an hour and 40 minutes, you know, or you got to tighten up that second act or that third act. I just feel like people can just do whatever they want
now. This is how I feel that if movies are being delivered to you in your home and you are sitting on your couch watching a movie, you can come back to it. You can turn it off, and you can't do these things in the theater. The theater has to give you, it seems to me, more structure and the experience of going to a movie. Whereas if you're in your house, you can interrupt it and watch the game for 40 minutes and go back to the movie. So if you're talking about guardrails, it does seem to me that if you're making a movie, you're making it for a different way of viewing it, right?
That's what you and I, again, that is how we all grew up thinking about a movie, that it's a discrete, unitary, singular experience. But I do think this whole kind of the migration of things like streaming, and I would argue even podcasts, too. I mean, I think a lot of filmmakers listen to podcasts, like a lot of people do.
Ari Melber doesn't, tell you that.
They love that freedom. You know, it's sort of like, wow, they can go down all these rabbit holes.
Yeah.
You know, da-da-da. And it's like, okay, yeah, but don't do that in your movie.
Right.
Don't do that in your movie.
But like, I wonder, too, if gaming is involved in that.
Totally.
What do you mean?
Well, you're playing a game, and then you could go down this side door and conquer this person, then swing on back this way and throw it.
Absolutely.
How do you know all that?
Well, I don't game, but...
No, you know. I think you're absolutely right, Jeannie. Yeah. I think that's all... It has all converged, and... As a matter of fact, another one of these like side conversations I had, like street conversations I had in L.A. was with an agent who used to package a lot of TV. And he's like, you know, back in the day with linear television, you had ads that would structure your episode. So you had seven acts because you had seven ads, you know, to be able to kind of do a cliffhanger for. Now with the binge and, you know, he was, quote, apparently, I need to find this, but like Quentin Tarantino was saying, with these endless series now, you have a first act, and then you have a second act, and then you have a second act, and you have a second act, and you have another second act.
Yeah.
And again, I think that a lot of these new forms and that those new imperatives have leached into feature filmmaking. And people are kind of and frankly, look, we don't have the moguls anymore to say, go back and cut it, you know? They don't have those people in their lives saying, nope, sorry, go back.
No, you're right. It's just like in everything. I mean, honestly, it's like the transfer portal. I mean, just, you know, the transfer portal, we would all agree. I know I'm going into sports here, but we would all agree that players, college kids, got no results out of all the money they brought in for every single college. They had nothing. Now they have everything, and it's a mess. It's just a mess. Total freedom is anarchy at some point. You know? But I mean, I'm sounding like an old man because I'm an old man. I will ask this. Of all the people that are individually nominated, regardless of the movie that they're in, are there one or two where you say, you have to see this movie for this performance?
That's a great question. You know, I would say I do think Andrea Riseborough delivered. I think she's, I've always been a fan of Andrea Riseborough, and I think her whole, you know, this whole way she got the nomination with the campaign of her peers and was wonderful, and it worked, and that's always exciting.
And that's in To Leslie.
That's called To Leslie.
Right.
And it's a, you know, she plays a an alcoholic hitting rock bottom, which, so it kind of plays into some of those tropes that I think we've seen before. But with, even with all of those sort of conceits in place, she's just always worth watching. So I would, you know, that is available on demand. With the dudes. You know, if those, like, I'm not a huge fan of Banshees of Inisherin, you know, because I'm not the biggest Martin McDonagh fan, but Colin Farrell is fantastic. He's just great, and he's had an amazing year.
I agree.
I mean, he's so, like, easy to kind of overlook and underrate, and he's really, he's just been fantastic.
I get all the Collins confused.
Colin Firth?
Yeah, I get them all confused, and then I don't know. The other ones who lose weight for movies that are not named Colin, and I just think they're really great. I think they're all great. I mean, just give me the accent. Just give me the accent. I think they're all great. Can I ask the other obvious question, which is, and maybe you're not aware of this, because maybe it's not in your bailiwick, as we say. Did the Golden Globes rate it all on television? And I bring that up because I wonder, the Academy Awards is usually the highest sort of non-sports show every year, and if the Golden Globes rated, I would say they would be again, but if the Golden Globes went down the drain, maybe the Oscars go down the drain.
I don't have that statistic at my fingertip, but my spidey sense, my sense is that, the ratings were not high for the Globes. But the thing about this year, though, is that there are some real big hit, like Top Gun and Avatar and Elvis. You know, and Austin Butler, I will also say, even though I was not a huge fan of the, especially the first half of Elvis, the second half of Elvis I thought was fascinating. And that, because that's when you, I felt like I really did see Austin Butler's performance come through. Like, it was like, whoa, this guy, he's amazing. I mean, it is a terrific performance.
Yeah. And then I'll see it.
And he has just, you know, a huge following from his days on Nickelodeon, you know, so there are all these, like, young adults, you know, who are completely into him. So I'm thinking, you know, that maybe the popularity of the nominated movies and people like him, I don't know, we'll see. Like, they've certainly been losing currency the last few years, and the pandemic didn't help, but maybe it'll turn around this year. You just don't know.
I'll tell you what I would do if I ran the Oscars. I'd have Will Smith as the host.
I would. You know they're going to have to address it. I mean, I will say that Globes, I thought I thought the host, and now I'm, so of course, blanking on his name. Was early, and I'm
Jeremy Carmichael.
Thank you, Gerard Carmichael. Thank you.
Yep.
I thought he was wonderful. I mean, he was so sophisticated, and I just thought he was great. But yeah, they're going to have to address it.
Sure.
I mean, people, to your point, they'll probably tune in to see that.
Yes, so. I would.
Of course. I mean, we're humans in the human zoo, after all.
I do have the ratings for the Golden Globes. Hmm. It's 6.3 million people, which was down from 6.9 the last time they did it.
Yeah.
And that was down from 18.3 in 2020.
That was that big.
They says the only time it was lower was during the writer's strike, when they got 6 million.
That's not good.
No, it's not.
Anne, feel better. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, guys. Thanks. It's great to hear your voices.
Hi, Anne.
Anne Hornaday, boys and girls. We'll come back with Email and Jingle. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
More banjo. More fiddle. That's Ian Warrington. He's playing all the instruments.
Wow.
And
what?
And he's an emergency room doctor.
Get out.
Oh, yes. He's an emergency room doctor.
What hospital?
He was at Sibley.
Yeah, he was at Sibley.
Oh,
I forget where
no.
he left Sibley. Yeah, I forget
we
where he's gone.
We need to find out.
Emergency
he is
room doctor.
For my
fairly
next
talented
emergency.
Guy. Yeah. Nigel, why don't you do the Bethesda Bagel ads? And people will be happy to know that after the show, that Gene and Liz and I and everybody here will have breakfast.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Bethesda Bagels. We love them. You will as well. Just go to BethesdaBagels.com, forward a location in the D.C. area nearest you, then pop on in, and you'll be thrilled.
Before we get to the mailbag, let's do this for Gene. Every day we sweat it out on the streets of a runaway American dream. At night we ride through the mansions of glory and suicide machines. Sprung from cages on Highway 9, chrome-wheeled, fuel-injected, and stepping out over the line. Baby, this town rips the bones from your back. It's a death trap. It's a suicide rap. Got to get out while we're young, because tramps like us, baby, we were born to run. That's, of course, Bruce Springsteen. And that is not... Mary is the other one. This is the name of the girl in this one at the end of the song. What's the name?
Wendy.
Right.
Yeah, sorry.
So Wendy and Mary are the prototypical names of people that Bruce Springsteen would have grown up with, particularly Mary, it seems to me.
Oh, yeah. Not Rosalita.
But Mary, you know, in a Catholic school environment and all of that.
Everybody
Mary
was named Mary.
Yeah. Well, not on my side of the street, but thanks to our guests
Catholic
today,
school.
Richard Justice and Ann Hornaday. Thanks to our sponsors, Butcher Box Indochino. Remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Odyssey. If you get the show through Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review. From Justin in Kelso, Washington, I am a wildlife biologist and at various times have worked on wolves. I worked at several zoos that housed wolves, and I can report to you they do the exact same thing you observed with Chessie. Wolves are known to howl in response to ambulance sirens. I have seen on several occasions wolves resting peaceful, only to snap to attention at the sound of a siren and howl back. Sometimes we could tell if an ambulance was in the area by the wolves. They often heard it before we did and would notify us via their howling. In fact, wildlife biologists studying wolves in nature have played siren calls to elicit a response and indicate wolves are in the area. Like others have said, I have only heard about this phenomenon with ambulance sirens, not those used by police or fire engines. So Chessie's behavior has deep evolutionary roots. Aww. But don't compare her or any other dog howl to those of a wolf. Few things get the blood pumping like the sound of a pack of wolves howling. It's exhilarating. And I would add scary.
Terrifying.
Because if they're coming for you, it's just not good. From John Agliata. So we're talking about Howard Johnson stories now, huh? Let's narrow it down to Howard Johnson's bathroom story, shall we? I've got one of those. When I was a boy, we visited a ranch in Montana. My sister got an ear infection and we couldn't fly home. So Dad was born and raised in the Bronx in the 1950s and a member of the doo-wop group Tommy and the Del Royals as a young man, rented a car and started driving us across country back to our suburban New York City home. Along the way, we stopped at a Hojo's in the middle of nowhere. As Dad and I entered the men's room, I heard him say, "Tommy," and the strange adult responded, "Jack." What followed was a 20-minute walk down memory lane accompanied by the pungent scent of urine cakes, bleach, and, well, let's just say ode to Hojo bathroom. Tommy and my dad, who was one of the guys in the background singing doobie-doo-wah on the band's only hit, Trust and Love, hadn't seen each other since the band parted ways more than a quarter century before.
Oh, my gosh.
Funny, the things that can happen in a Hojo bathroom somewhere in the middle of nowhere.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
The chances of that are zero.
Yeah, yeah.
They're simply zero. Zero. From David Catania. Mr. Tony, Laurel Little here in Galena, Ohio, zip code, ooh, yes, of Africa Road infamy. Speaking of marmots, do I pronounce that right? Marmots, not marmots. A couple of summers ago, me and the mask and two of my children, late high school, early college age, took our Jeep out to Colorado and finally conquered the wonderfully rough National Forest Road up to Hermit Pass in the San Isabel National Forest. Long story short, the younger masculine child forged ahead on our subsequent backpacking trip into the adjoining Sangre de Cristo wilderness area and sort of disappeared for long enough that the older masculine child was dispatched back to the Jeep in case the missing child happened to have doubled back for whatever reason. All ended well as the missing masculine child eventually reappeared out of the inky shadows, but the older child had to spend the night alone at 13,000 feet in the Jeep. Oh. Not really a huge deal, except that he would occasionally hear chewing noises on the bottom of the Jeep. What was it? Marmots. Turns out these cute little guys are actually furry little devils known to happily chew on the underside of vehicles, sometimes even destroying brake lines, etc.
Oh my God.
That did not turn out to be our misfortune, but who knew? A good night's rest was apparently not enjoyed by the older masculine child. From Peter Schwab in Marina Del Rey in California. I wanted to give you something to look forward to in 2023 and be a motivator to get you to the end of the year. On the last day of the year, 12/31/23, the numbers will numerically be 123, 123. Information for life.
Oh boy, here we go.
That's a good one.
From Dave Lord in Odenton, Maryland. I experienced the DA moment listening to Friday's show. When you said the song played was Get Up by Eric Scott, I said, I know that guy. Not only do I know that guy, I taught that guy. Eric was one of my math students at Stephen Decatur Junior High School in Clinton, Maryland during the 1977-78 school year. We reconnected a few years ago when my wife and I went to see him play at the Waugh Chapel Shopping Center in Crofton, Maryland. We've seen him play a couple of times since then. He's an extremely talented musician, very personal individual. He plays at several different locations in the Annapolis, Baltimore, D.C. area, and I encourage all the littles to go see him play. Thanks for playing his songs and summing up pleasant memories. These things are amazing. From Eric Carlson, were there any soft kittens training among the students on the tall ship? That's Norwegian soft kittens. That's just funny. That's funny. From Henry Gudelski. Thank you howling on Wednesday's show. Remember, I just howled for a while. A moment, I could have sworn my old husky Shadow was sitting right next to me. Shadow was raised for his formative years in a frat house at the University of Maryland. Oh, he would sleep in like all the other college kids in our house and wouldn't get up until I did every day, even if that meant sometimes after noon. When he did wake up, he'd do a nice big downward dog stretch, let out a nice throaty howl, just like Dr. Tony, and go with me on a nice walk. Shadow was known on multiple occasions for taking your pizza right out of your hand if you weren't paying attention, but somehow he always knew to only take the pledge's food. After college, his greatest food theft came at Thanksgiving one year, where he got to put his college education to work. After my mom took the turkey out of the oven and rested it on the island, she came out to let us know dinner was ready. She couldn't have left the turkey alone for more than 5 minutes, yet Shadow managed to climb the island and inhale the entire thing. About an hour later, we enjoyed some great Chinese takeout while Shadow passed out on the couch. Murray Moman in Winnipeg. I'll give it a shot, sure. After graduating university and getting my first real job, I also got a rescue mutt that turned out to be a Portuguese water dog. Great dog, had a long and fulfilling life. However, one time, when I guess I was away from the house too long, it ate the index finger of my baseball glove. That's it, just the index finger. I still use that glove on weekends, and I couldn't really afford a new one at the time. I had a buddy who did leather work, so he sewed the thumb of my glove to the middle finger. I played a few years with a glove just like that. It worked perfectly fine. Big glove wasn't going to get a dime out of me. From Kevin Boyer in Columbia, Missouri. We've had five bulldogs. They are notorious for eating what they should not. The first two were brothers, Bentley and Barrington. Bentley had a habit of chewing on the corners of things, doors, cabinets, and walls. He took a corner in the kitchen through the paneling, the drywall under it, and down the corner bead steel frame. He tore the stainless trim off the refrigerator. After cooking a pretty big roast, I pulled the bone out of the middle, and since he was standing right behind me, I reached down and gave it to him. I turned back around to attend to the roast and heard a loud snapping noise behind me. I turned to look. He'd bitten it clean in half. When meeting people on one of our short walks at the park, I always had to warn them, he won't bite, but if he does, he won't let go. As Roy Hamilton said, don't let go a long time ago. I should do one more because this is on a personal note. This is from Tom Mosser. And we have taken his beautiful painting.
Yes.
Of a dog sitting in a museum looking at
a painting of a tennis ball.
And we have put that on the PTI show all week so far, and it will be there all week. And he said, "This is so cool, seeing my painting of Lucas behind Tony. My phone is blowing up a little's emails. Thanks so much for making this happen. So much fun. A little told me that Dan Byrne is playing Pittsburgh on February 1st at a great little club called Club Cafe, and I'm going with my fiance. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, do wear white."
Now they all get involved, and they all got their gear all ready, and so they're going to be all colored up in the maroon and black.
You're a moron. You're a moron.
too soon.